Health IQ.
It's life insurance. They take A-rated life insurance companies and pair them with people that are in shape, and then they get low rates because typically if you're in good shape, you have good health.
Yes, you do.
The other thing that they do is they do these quizzes that will help educate you and make you even healthier.
Love it.
Makes you better. We're going to do a quiz today. It's on running form.
I'm ready.
You ready for this?
Yes, I am.
Freeman?
Yep.
First question. When in the middle of a run, focusing on what can often improve your form and speed?
Ooh, cadence. Oh, go on.
You can't say
that. I forgot.
It's a multiple choice.
Okay.
Flexing leg muscles manually.
Well, no.
Tensing your arms.
No.
Looking down.
Negative.
Relaxing your body.
I'm going to go relaxing the body.
That is correct.
Good.
Next question. When using a treadmill, the risk of what type of injury might be higher than if you were on a track?
Taking a left-hand turn.
Myochondrial infarction. Sorry, I don't even know what that is.
Heart attack.
Quad strain.
No.
Ankle injury or femur rotation.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to go with C.
Ankle injury?
Yes.
I think that. Okay, I'll say that. But oh, you're right.
Well, don't.
That is correct.
Scott, why,
Freeman,
why'd you
impressed.
Even doubt?
Our last health IQ education question
right.
is, side leg lifts are great stretches to improve hip range of motion.
Okay.
Potentially decreasing risk of what? IT band syndrome.
That's it.
Achilles tendon tear.
Nope.
Radial break.
Negative.
Ankle sprain.
Easy. That's IT band.
IT. You are correct. Congratulations, Don. You have scored well today.
And I qualify to be a healthy participant with Health IQ Group.
That means you also qualify to have reduced life insurance rates.
I'm in. Go to our partners page.
And link on over, or you can enter healthiq/TRN.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll
Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even, you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's, yeah. Yeah.
Frank. Yeah, yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War.
I'm Brad Kearns, and I'm glad to be here.
Zach Bitter.
All right. Hey, we're back at the round table.
Zach Bitter actually put up a cot in Studio G, and he's just been living here.
But he does have another 50 miles under his on his shoes, on his ultras.
Oh, he did his training.
He did his training. But
he did
he's
his
just
training
sleeping
run. This is where he recovers.
We're happy to have Brad Kearns here from Primal Endurance Podcast, as well as a multiple-time author and former professional triathlete and just an endurance specialist all around, including some high jumping and all kinds of stuff you're still involved with, huh?
Speed golf.
Speed golf is my connection to the endurance world, and it's I think it's the greatest sport on the planet. We could do a whole podcast on that, but we won't.
And perhaps we should sometime.
Speed golf nation. Maybe we should start a new podcast.
Especially for all the adventurous trail runners. I know that, you know, 62% of your audience has golf clubs in the garage. I mean, that's just statistically, everyone knows how to play golf,
they're
right?
Rusty.
Yeah.
To get used.
Yeah, that's right. But maybe. It's like you could put your passions together here where you're getting a workout and playing golf, which is the opposite of the actual golf experience where I don't have time. You don't get a workout, and it's boring. And so now you get out there, and the speed golf thing is where they're counting your time on the course and your strokes and adding them together. So you have to play well, but you also have to move well. And it's a real zen experience because you're no longer in that overly deliberate, overly analytical state of mind like golfers are.
Yeah.
This time you're just kind of reacting. You get up to your ball. You take a quick look. You grab one of the clubs because you're only carrying five clubs and swing, and it's really fun.
Wow.
You know, Candace Burt is an innovator in trail running. I think that maybe we should get her to invent the first trail run with holes.
There are plenty of holes already out
so
there that we try to avoid.
A 200-mile race with 56 holes.
Scott, we'd spend all the time looking for balls.
And you could use your trekking poles as the club.
Well, the Tarahumara played the ball game, so yeah, it's not that far off.
There
you
go.
Yeah, yeah. Bring this back. We bring this back full circle and have, you know, you get a golf club and a ball, and it's called the Tarahumara Speed Golf Trail Run Extravaganza.
Ooh, let's trademark that.
Sponsored by Zach Bitter.
.com. We've already got the URL. The URL secured. So you've written a new book, Brad. You've got a lot of research, and you've spent some time pen to paper and have put some good thoughts together, and we want to talk about that stuff.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, this has been fun. It kind of started, that's kind of how I got connected with you, Zach, was like plunging into this world of this exciting expanded world of fat-adapted endurance training, ketogenic endurance training. So the book is called The Keto Reset, and Mark Sisson and I have been full deep into this mode for the last several months, experimenting with ourselves. I went into a 140-day keto period for the first time, really, I would say, where I was really trying hard and I think doing pretty well. I don't know about that chocolate, man, that adds up. You take that 85% dark chocolate and you can get over 50 grams a day just eating chocolate. I can guarantee you that. But I was mainly just eating chocolate and vegetables and trying to stay at that 50-gram limit, which is believed by a lot of the experts to help get you into nutritional ketosis. So for that about 140-day period, I kind of had a nice experience on some of the intended benefits of doing that and how it can really fine-tune your fat adaptation and contribute to your endurance performance especially, but also strength and power and intensity performance. There's a whole game now and a whole following of people that are sort of from the CrossFit mode that are seeing that keto has a wonderful protein-sparing effect, for one thing, because you're not burning sugar and not needing to get into gluconeogenesis during those recovery periods after you've done a big strength workout in the gym. You know you got to rebuild those muscles and you're a sugar burner. And so now if you're keto, you're not burning that much glycogen in the first place. You're on this sort of alternative metabolism where you can recover faster. You have less inflammation. This is for all athletes, really. You know, reducing that inflammatory response to exercise is so important because that's what recovery is to moderate that inflammation, wake up, feel better, go out there and do another difficult workout. And boy, oh boy, that's, you know, one of the eye-openers is just my thing now is, first of all, I'm an old guy, right? I'm 52 years old, and I go out there and I like to sprint and high jump. And when I go hard and do a hard sprint workout combination with high jump, I'm fried for like 7 or 8 or 9 days. I'm into United Chiropractic in Rockland, California to get adjustments all over my body. And it's just tough. It's tough on the body. But I noticed during this keto phase, as well as throwing in targeted use of the new ketogenic, the ketone supplements, that 36 hours later or 48 hours later, I was less sore and I was less fried. And so I don't like when people claim that I perform better when I took this drink or because of my diet, I was sprinting faster. It's like, no, the stress response and the stress hormones are the things that are going to get you to the finish line faster than the other guy. It's not the change in whatever fuel you're using so much. But I did feel like the workouts are less stressful and I could recover faster from my dietary changes and my supplement use.
Let's back up just a minute for those of our listeners that heard.
We want to go forward, Scott. We're not ever backing up in life. That's okay.
Sometimes you get off the trail and you have to backtrack a little bit to get back next to the ribbons. For those of you who are listening that have never heard the word ketogenesis or ketone supplement or anything like that, what is the difference between low-carb diet and a ketogenic diet?
Well, this was discovered in 1921 by Zach Bitter. And
in utero.
Yeah, let's hear what the champ says.
What is the difference?
And that's a really good question. I think a lot of times those words get used interchangeably, and it can kind of confuse people because they think, someone who's on a high fat diet or someone who's on a ketogenic diet are doing the exact same thing. And really the way that I've kind of differentiated those two words is a ketogenic diet is very much like a nutritional or a medical kind of approach where you're keeping your carb intake down to like 50 grams or less, and in some cases 20, 30 grams of carbohydrate. And you're intentionally keeping it that low so that your body doesn't have access to like exogenous glucose. And, you know, it's been used for a variety of things over the years. Lately, it's been used more or been focused more on like folks who have trouble with like diabetes or have, you know, other health issues. And I think when we kind of go a little forward with that and try to start utilizing it for like performance and sports related things, that's when we start getting into like the higher fat side where you're not necessarily following a specific protocol of X amount of grams or less per day, but you're more so focusing on maximizing your ability to metabolize fat. And that might not mean dropping all the way down to 50 grams or less. You know, it might mean that you're eating 150 grams of carbohydrates per day or something like that. But you're very much relying primarily on fat as your primary fuel source.
So is one diet more geared toward a higher fat than another one? Or does it matter?
I would say, like, just by definition, like a strict ketogenic diet would be more fat because in that type of a scenario, you're not only looking at keeping your carbs low, but you're also looking at keeping your protein really low. Because like what you happen to notice a lot of times, if people are, if they're cutting their carbs out, sometimes they end up really ramping up their protein, and excess protein can be converted into glucose through a process called nucleogenesis.
Ooh, whoa, let me write that one down.
Yeah, it's I couldn't spell it for you if you wanted me to, but I can tell you what it means. It basically means the body taking excess protein and converting it into glucose energy. Which, you know, as your body would recognize that as a fuel source, and it could potentially kick you out of what they would consider ketosis. And I think too, another way to kind of differentiate between the two things is, like when you're in nutritional ketosis, you're producing like what they've clinically defined as 0.5 millimoles of ketone bodies, or greater. So they can figure that out by like blood draws and stuff like that. And, you know, that's when you can kind of tell, okay, I'm in nutritional ketosis. So if you're someone who's trying to follow a strict ketogenic diet, you're probably paying attention to those things. And if you're not getting above that 0.5 millimoles, then you're probably needing to adjust something, whether it's carbohydrates, protein, or increase your fat intake, that type of stuff.
How do you know whether you're in ketosis? Is it just by measuring the number of grams of carbohydrates you're intaking per day, or do you actually use a finger prick test?
Yeah, you can get blood ketone monitors, and kind of like it'll tell you exactly like you're at 1.5 millimoles. And then you know, like, okay, I'm well past that 0.5 mark, so I'm in nutritional ketosis by definition. Most people probably don't do that. Partly, you know, it's slightly invasive. If you're pricking your finger and taking blood draws, it's not necessarily cheap either. Yeah, you buy a monitor, which isn't too expensive, but the strips are pretty pricey. So if you're gonna want to, if you want to do that multiple times a day, you're gonna spend some money. So what I think most people will do if they're really, really serious about it, and certainly if it's if they're doing it for like a medical reason, they're going to test themselves while they're doing different types of foods, eating different types of foods to kind of see what foods are keeping them in ketosis versus what foods are kind of throwing them out of ketosis. And that's how they get that hard like piece of data to show like, okay, I'm where I need to be. For someone like myself, where I'm using a high fat diet for recovery and performance, and it's fluctuating depending on where I'm at in my training, I'm not as concerned about whether where my millimoles of ketone bodies are at. You know, I'm more concerned about, well, was I able to
throw down on the race course?
Exactly.
And kick everyone's ass.
Yeah, performance, workout recovery. Like, you know, if I'm doing workouts and I feel like steady state of energy and stuff for long, long periods of time, like hours and hours out there, then I know I'm at a high enough fat burning rate where I don't need to rely on, you know, lots of external fuel source during these workouts. And then I know like, okay, I'm where I need to be from a performance standpoint.
Brad, I saw you writing down a bunch of stuff over there. What kind of things are you writing over there?
It says Costco paper towels, toilet paper, bottled water. No, just kidding. This is a really, you know, I've been deep into this for the last 5 months, and there's some really interesting nuances that I think could be brought up. Since I think we're going to go deep in the show, I think a lot of your listeners are probably
we're going
already,
way deep.
You know, they're already into this fat adapted vibe and wondering what it's all about and how maybe to check it out. And so if you've been playing around with this keto thing and even doing the testing, you get this precision extra blood meter on Amazon. I forget, it's $50 or $40. And then the strips are like $3 for this stupid little test strip.
Yeah.
You can go on eBay and like they ship them in from like Greece and Turkey and you can get them for $1 to $2 a strip. So I'm an expert on wheeling and dealing for ketone test strips. But yeah, you prick your finger, you test, and there's certain times of day and in certain circumstances where you're going to get the highest readings. And interestingly, like first thing in the morning, you're going to get a low keto reading because you haven't been burning that much fat overnight. So it's like Dom D'Agostino, one of the leading scientists in this game, he says like, do a hard workout and then sit around for a couple hours and that's when you'll get rock star readings because your body's producing the ketones to keep up with the workout demand at that time. And then you stop and sit around and so they're circulating in your blood at a high level. But one thing that was interesting to me was like, I was going for it pretty well. I'm working out. I'm fasted, you know, 18 hours. I'm pricking my finger and I'm getting a 0.4 or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what's up with that? You know, what else do you want from me? I'm trying my hardest around here. And Dr. Kate Shanahan, I consulted with her a lot on the book. I think she's probably one of the foremost minds on this fat adapted living and training. She's working with the Lakers and the top athletes for their nutritional planning and also a lot of other people that are on the cutting edge, like D'Agostino and Peter Attia and Phil Maffetone. Finney and Volek have been talking about this stuff for 30 years. No one's listened until the last couple years. So, you know, this is like a bandwagon thing. I give credit to the people that have been doing this for a long time. But sometimes you can get a low reading, especially if you're an athletic specimen that's doing a lot of training, because your body's making just what you need at that time and not making extra, which is how the body works. And so because I wasn't under heavy athletic demand on that day and I'm burn a lot of calories, I make the glucose that I need. And some of my glucose readings were high, even though I hadn't seen a sugar in a week and had very low carbohydrate intake. It's just because my body's kicking into that gluconeogenesis mode. It's not on an emergency high stress level like we commonly refer to it when you're starving and you go into stress response. It was just sort of this elegant way of making whatever macronutrients I needed, whatever fuel substrates I needed at that time. So my kind of my point, I'm rambling, but it's like you don't get too caught up on the numbers, mainly because they're expensive is one reason. But also like Zach said, and this is like Dr. Kate has a questionnaire that we put in the book about this. It's like, hey, can you wake up without eating, and can you go a couple hours after that without eating, without cratering? And if you can, that's an indication that you're very well fat and keto adapted. And if you know if you can't answer yes to these questions, it might be much more important to focus on the practical application of being fat and keto adapted rather than obsessed with these numbers.
Okay. I got off course again. I'm down a trail. I've almost made it like a half a mile off course. And I need to get back on course. What is a ketone, and how do we produce more?
Yeah, we'll edit this into the start of the show because what are these guys talking about?
Yeah, I think it's important to know what a ketone is. It's a fuel source, right?
Yeah. So this is the fourth macronutrient, and most people have no idea that
fifth they become alcohol.
Oh yeah, alcohol is a caloric energy source too. So when your blood glucose, your insulin, and your liver glycogen are all low due to carbohydrate restriction, you are going to make these energy byproducts called ketones or ketone bodies. The liver will make them as a byproduct of fat metabolism. So when fat metabolism is ramped up and you don't have that readily available fuel source of carbs, because when you bang a gel or a 7-Up, your body's going to burn that right away. It's easy burning, quick burning, dirty burning fuel source. So when you're in this ketogenic state, this ketosis state, you have this wonderful alternative to glucose that your body can burn in the same manner as glucose. And this has been from, you know, now we're in the evolutionary health scene here where, you know, humans for 2.5 million years did not have a steady supply of any food, and they never had a high level of carbohydrate intake until the last 10,000 years of civilization. So we've relied on ketones to survive through human evolution. It's a critical part of being able to still function while we're starving or in a fasted state. And so your brain loves to burn ketones, your heart loves to burn ketones, just in the same manner that it does glucose. So it's a glucose substitute, and by the way, it burns much more cleanly along with fat fat and ketones burn much more cleanly than glucose. So you have this anti-inflammatory, improved oxygen delivery to the brain, especially everything about the ketone benefits are especially important to the brain because the brain's so sensitive to oxygen source, and that's why we have these cognitive decline diseases that are so prevalent now, and the increase is alarming and shocking and very disturbing because that's the last thing you want to go from is Alzheimer's, dementia, things like that. And it's from crappy food and burning sugar our whole lives and not getting sufficient oxygen delivery to the brain. Zach mentioned that the ketones have been used for seizure medication or seizure treatments to drug-resistant seizures, the worst kind, where they couldn't handle the drugs. Since 1921, the first Dr. Wilder discovered that if you put people on a ketogenic diet, they'll be protected from seizures. Why? Because their brains are finally getting enough oxygen and reducing the inflammation from burning glucose. So ketones, that's why it's a hot thing right now. It's like it's only 2.5 million years old since the since the dawn of human evolution. But your body works much more efficiently when it's in a ketone burning state than in a overfed glucose burning state.
We talked about in our podcast earlier this month with Zach and with Chris. We talked about ketone supplements. So if your body isn't making or you're not in a situation where you're in a fat metabolizing ketone building phase, there are these things on the market now, ketone supplements. Is that cheating or is that a way to also increase your ketones in your blood system?
Is it cheating?
Well,
yes, it is. I mean, this is a trip because this, I mean, I thought of the word like hangover cure. This sounds like a hangover cure for you go slamming your Cheesecake Factory at your birthday party.
Right.
And then you mix this packet of stuff and drink it, and all of a sudden you're in ketosis.
You mean I can have the cheesecake
and this is
be
a very,
in ketosis?
You know, it's a very sensitive topic. I mean, I asked D'Agostino point blank. He's the guy who's formulated some of the first products on the market. I'm like, what's the deal here? And he's like, yeah, we're doing our own cupcake study in the lab right now. That's what he called it. In other words, can you right the ship after a glucose bomb with a ketone supplement or override, for example, getting into nutritional ketosis? How do you do it? You cut your carbs to 50 grams a day. It might take you 3 bloody weeks if you're a real sugar burner, and it's extremely rigorous to do that. And if you eat a little too much protein, high protein diet is a high sugar diet. We know that because your body cannot handle excess protein. It'll excrete it and convert it to sugar. Mm-hmm. So this is a big deal here to think like, wow, I can sit here and take a supplement and get these wonderful benefits of nutritional ketosis. That term is implying that you're doing it through diet. And now you're taking supplemental ketones and you're there. You're like, it's pretty wild stuff. So my opinion is like these supplements have a lot of potential, but of course they are best used in a foundational situation of low carbohydrate, high fat eating so that you can kind of leverage that rather than truly use it as a Cheesecake Factory cure. And this show is brought to you by the Cheesecake Factory. If you go there and tell them that you learned this is the Trailrunner Nation.
You just put in the code TRN and you don't have to tip. You mentioned something interesting about protein, about excess protein
right.
is just as detrimental as excess carbohydrates.
Perhaps worse, yeah, due to the growth factor stimulation. I mean, if you want to live a long life and not accelerate the aging process,
yeah.
It's very important to not get excess carb intake nor excess protein intake.
Let's define how much protein intake. Does that back in the day, we used to determine how much protein based on body mass size. If you're a mm-hmm. linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys, you can have more than the cheerleader.
Yeah.
So where do we stand with that? What's the current thought on how much protein should we have not to sabotage our fat-adapted body?
Yeah. Some of the leaders in this thinking now are dialing back the commonly recommended protein intake that's been there for decades. And in fact, among all the world of diet and nutritional science, there's been a pretty good consensus on protein. High-fat camp, low-carb, high-carb camp, those are completely, I mean, we're still dealing with this war that's going to happen for the next 20 years until we finally, succumb to realizing that fat's the nutritious fuel and carbs are, kind of the enemy and the cause of metabolic syndrome and the disease patterns. But with protein, it's always been a function of body weight, but also the conventional recommendation has been to up your intake based on your activity level. Mm-hmm. And so commonly cited quotes are 0.5 gram per pound of a lot of people use total body mass. We're talking about lean body mass when we're coming to the cutting edge here. Dr. Ron Rosedale and people like that at the front. But 0.5 gram per pound if you're inactive, 0.7 if you're moderately active, and if you're a badass, you go all the way up to 1 gram per pound of body weight. So if you know you weigh 170 pounds, that's 170 grams of protein. Now, you know what we're recommending and a lot of people are saying is 0.5 gram per pound of lean mass, not total mass, but lean mass, because you're concerned about preserving lean mass. So if I weigh 160, I'm 10% fat, I have 146 pounds of lean mass, right? Mm-hmm. Cutting that in half is only 72 grams of protein. That's a big difference from 160. But in the picture of your entire caloric intake, it's not that big of a difference. It's still, protein is a very moderate total contribution to your daily caloric intake, and you're getting most of your calories from fat, not only because they're more calorically dense, because you don't need much more than that. And so the latest, greatest thinking is that even if you're athletic, even if you're running 100 miles a week ultra, you don't need that much more because your body is more and more efficient at using protein as an athlete as opposed to a sedentary person. So even a hard training athlete might be just fine getting by on somewhere around 0.5 grams per lean mass at the low end. I think Finney and Volek are saying 0.8 was their thing. So, you know, there's a little bit of variation there among all the experts. But again, we're talking about splitting hairs when you're talking about your fat intake is ideally 70% of your total calories, whatever, something number like that.
Let's talk about timing and spreading that protein out. Because if you, from what I recall, putting it all in at once is detrimental or not efficient, because your body can only break down so much protein at any given time. 30 grams or something is what I remember. And so taking that salt, that entire protein content or caloric content for the day may not be the best way to go. You may want to graze and spread it out. Any thoughts to that? I'm not stating anything of fact. Just how about grazing versus piling it all your protein in at once?
So I think, you know, if you're looking at a typical person, then you probably can't process much above 30 grams at any one given time. I think what they're starting to recognize now, and maybe Brad can correct me if I'm wrong here, but a lot of folks who are taking a more high fat approach and maybe eating fewer meals during the day and kind of loading all their calories into like a couple meals as opposed to like six small ones or something like that. What we're noticing is there's another process that happens when you're eating, and it's the bile secretion. So the biles that get secreted when you eat something help digest the food. So when you aren't constantly pinging that to happen, when you have a bigger meal, say after like, you know, a 6 or 7 hour layoff from eating, your body has more bile to release. And therefore when taken in with fatty acid, like a fatty meal, you can probably get away with a few more grams of protein, than you maybe would have been able to traditionally if you're following a more standard like meal approach that you'd see like commonly where you're, you know, three meals a day, two small snacks or something like that.
You know, we should have put a disclaimer at the front of this podcast that people should listen to this at half speed and capture all the information. So you guys just took away my two favorite food groups, carbohydrates and protein.
Cheesecakes. Oh.
And cheesecake. So three. My question is this ketogenic diet palatable and sustainable?
70% we're talking about. That's a big change from the 60-20-20 or, you know, whatever those other terms were.
I guess that's my biggest concern as I get into here. Since talking to some of you guys, for months now, I've changed my diet to it probably be considered a low-carb diet. And I'm entertaining this ketogenic diet, but I love my protein. I've cut out the carbs, so I'm low-carb. But is it really something that is palatable, is higher fat, lower protein, lower carb, palatable and sustainable? And Zach, I know your answer. You're going, yeah, duh, it is. I've been doing it for... I guess my question is explain that to me. How do we make it palatable? How do we make it sustainable?
Well, I mean, if it's sustainable for a guy running 120 miles a week, don't be whining to me that it's not sustainable. I mean, you're burning that much energy and you can stay in here. And I think you kind of break through this banner, like in Roseville High School Tigers football game. Before the game, the cheerleaders paint the banner, and you break through the banner, and you're into this amazing new world where this is kind of Mark Sisson's, you know, number one elevator line on this whole thing is, you're not hungry. And when you're not hungry, or when your hunger is regulated, your whole perspective of food changes, and you can do anything. You can skip a day of eating with no trouble, but you have to get fat and keto adapted first. And we're used to living our entire lives, since the day we went off breast milk, which is 55% fat, by the way, into baby formulas and all the goldfish and all the crap. Don't feed your kids goldfish, please, listeners. You're killing them. You're putting refined vegetable oils in there. Yeah. But when you got hooked on carbs when you were an infant, until you're listening to this show and deciding to change your life by the end of the show, it's time to reflect on the bigger picture of, wow, my appetite hormones are, you know, designed to be regulated. I'm designed to be at high satiety level, whether I'm eating or not. And if you're trying to lose weight and you become fat and keto adapted, you can have that morning omelet with the bacon on the side and the avocados and the salsa and delicious cheese and vegetables inside. It's not going to spike your blood sugar. It's not going to spike insulin. It's a delicious omelet, and you're going to be fueled for hours after. But if you skip the omelet and eat breakfast off your ass, you're going to lose weight, and you're going to be fueled and feel good for hours after. And these are like the quiz I was referring to with Kate Shanahan, saying, can you go omelet for breakfast and power through your workday, or can you wake up and have some green tea and power through your workday? And that's an indication that you're very efficient at burning stored body fat. You're not struggling, suffering, and starving, because none of those types of dietary approaches will ever work, and you're going to be Ben and Jerry's at night, no matter who you are and how badass you are when you're talking about your fast at 1 p.m. and bragging to your podcast guests.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get to this metabolic state where our appetite hormones are moderated, our fat metabolism is optimized, and there anything's possible. And to answer the question finally, you know, you're thinking about what foods qualify in this category. The omelet that I just mentioned, salads, fish, steak. I mean, the most satiating and delicious foods. A lot of them are savory. I know we have our sweets and all that kind of stuff. But I'm going to put a pitch in here to say, look, you know, I had the sweetest of sweet tooths myself growing up in my life, and being a triathlete and being able to train so many hours and eat whatever I wanted, and I like the frozen yogurt and the cookies on top and all that stuff. But if you sit back and look at the big picture evaluation of how sugar makes your body feel, I'm going to argue that anyone out there can sit back and say, you know, I can't say this is really a foundational element of enjoying life. You often feel like crap when you're cycling through a roller coaster day of high carbohydrate ingestion, high insulin production. It's no comparison to being metabolically efficient.
Can we go back anthropologically, back in the day, this tribal member? You know, can you just kind of take us through what they ate, what they looked like, what was available, and why we were hardwired for the diet that you're talking about? Why over the last 10,000 years, all of these readily available, processed, man-made calories that can fit in your pocket and are well-preserved, why those have become convenient. But what did the lifestyle look like of that tribal member walking around out there? What kind of foods were available? Do you guys have any thoughts? I may have sabotaged you and caught you off guard with the question. And I know maybe that you're not ready for that. But we can make stuff up if we need to.
That's true, Runner Nation.
Yes. Yeah. So what was available back in those days when they're in the savannah and chasing down animals and picking up nuts? I mean, how does that look like, very much like the diet that you're talking about?
Oh, I wasn't there back then. I was born into modern times. And I'm sensitive right now to the popularity of this, you know, primal paleo, low-carb, ancestral keto movement, and then the skeptics and, you know, the counter opinions, and then we get lost into all this noise where your next guest next week is going to be, you know, one of Dean Ornish's disciples talking about how bad fat is to eat. And it gets really confusing and frankly disturbing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's books criticizing the Paleolithic diet because we didn't really eat that much meat, or they actually ate grains back then. And all this stuff is really nonsense. And I think we need to just kind of get focused on the fact that we know what our ancestors ate, we know the group of foods that they ate from, and we know that they didn't eat Slurpees and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take those, you know, simple steps where there's no dispute, And then we realize that we're pretty adaptable creatures. We can eat all kinds of stuff and thrive and survive because the people up in the poles ate a lot differently than people on the equator. And they still came out really well, and none of them had heart disease and all those great things. So today, we're looking at things like personal preference and adherence to a diet. And you have to figure out things that are going to work best for you. So if we say that sardines, and the show is sponsored by sardines today.
Mm-hmm.
So if you use your coupon.
We're getting a lot of sponsorships today.
If we say sardines are great for you and you hate them, that's not going to work out too well.
Right.
If we say you should have an omelet with bacon every day and you don't like either of those things, that's not going to work out too well either. So we have to get to a thing where we feel comfortable personally and emphatic that this is working for us. And that's why I go back to my last comment. It's like, is it really working for you to power through your day with three Clif Bars in your drawer and you fade and then you bang a Clif Bar and you feel good for 2 hours and then at the end of the day you're completely fried and you're just sitting there pushing your Netflix button, you don't even know what you're watching, all that kind of stuff. There's a new possibility now where you improve your metabolic function by becoming fat and keto adapted, and that is undisputably the Homo sapiens factory setting, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, we are fat burning beasts and we've become carbohydrate dependent, carbohydrate addicts due to the advent of civilization and the high carb diet. And then just to transition over to Zach, because he's just come back from his short run while I was talking. Here's, you know, the highest level of elite athletic performance in ultra-distance running, asking the maximum for your body and endurance, and they're transitioning over to fat-adapted training and eating. So if you're not paying that much attention to now, we got to find out why this is working. And to answer, I want him to answer your question about, is it sustainable?
Zach, is it sustainable?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different ways to look at that, and one of them is like this process that we go through when we learn something new, and it's kind of like depending on where you're coming from. So like I remember when I first started exploring taking a higher fat approach in my own training, racing, and recovery, my first question was, well, how am I going to cut back on the amount of potatoes I eat? You know, I was like, I ate a ton of potatoes back then and I liked them. And I was just like thinking, man, what am I going to do without that? And I look back at that now and I find it really, really silly. And also eye opening because it's not necessarily a one step process. Mm-hmm. So like, sometimes I liken it to like, you know, you get someone who's hasn't worked out in years and then they sign up at a gym and they get a trainer and they're going to go all in. And that trainer takes them through the gauntlet and then tells them they got to start eating better, tells them they got to start sleeping better, tells them they got to drink X ounces of water. Information overload. Like that person is going to probably be all in for a couple weeks and then just like implode and then stop and fall back and end up at the Cheesecake Factory. But yeah. So a lot of times it's you take a more sustainable approach and you kind of look at like, okay, where's this person at? Where's this person been at for the last few years? And kind of work forward like that. Like you have an end goal, but you don't necessarily need to get there the next day. So like what I always tell people is like to make anything sustainable, like let's start with something simple, like one or two things, and start with that. And then once you've got that down, let's take another couple steps.
First, ditch that lousy girlfriend who's holding you back. Second, cut some carbs out of your diet. Got it. I like that approach.
And I think like more often than not, like the way I would coach someone through something like this would be, well, first let's get rid of the processed stuff. Let's get to this. Like, I mean, you can talk to like people all around the world who've got super different approaches in their nutrition, from like vegan, vegetarian, to high fat, to paleo, to, you know, all these different things. And, you know, every one of these camps, so to speak, can really point to people that are just thriving on their approach. But one thing you can't do is point to someone within that thriving group that has a highly processed diet. At least I haven't seen anything.
What about Jared from Subway?
Where is he now? That's a different topic altogether.
Zach's from Wisconsin. Jared is housed there at the correctional facility in the middle of the state. He doesn't have any Subway sandwiches. That's a good point. That leverages this, you know, this controversy on what diet's right. It's like Rip Esselstyn, my old friend from triathlon, is now a best-selling author of the Engine 2 Diet. He's in Whole Foods, and he's very much...
Now we know Brad Kern's ringtone. That's nice. Brown Sugar, I think that was on. By Rolling Stones.
By the way, we're edit free, by the way.
Yeah, that's going to be on the show.
Okay, that's fine. The caller will be very impressed that they made it onto the show. So, you know, rips of super low-fat, plant-based, grain-friendly diet. So we had some interesting talks and had, you know, some nice meals where we could have that common ground. And there's a whole ton of common ground from even the most extreme vegan, vegetarian type mentality to the keto and the hardcore paleo. Some people are eating meat and eggs and the other people aren't, but there's a lot of common ground. And the one of them is, you know, getting rid of the processed crap as a starting point, especially when you're talking coach-client relationships. So that's my interjection, and then we're carrying on.
Well, and it gets more, it gets easier too, like when I think of like if I'm eating whole natural foods, like in the ability to like just take in an insane amount of carbohydrate through whole natural foods is actually relatively difficult. Like, I mean, if you put like a whole package of Oreos in front of me, I could eat the whole package and like my stomach wouldn't blow up. But like if you put like the equivalent in calories in like apples in front of me, like, you know, I would stop before I even got to a fraction of the caloric intake from those apples as to the Oreos. So like, you know, sometimes you by switching to like a whole food approach, you're going to automatically probably lower the person's sugar intake, like their really high carb intake type of food groups. And so you're actually kind of taking a step forward in a direction they don't necessarily recognize. To them, they're just like, okay, we're getting rid of all the packaged stuff. We're getting rid of all the processed stuff. That's the first step, but really they're maybe taking a couple steps by doing that. And then, you know, it's one of those things where you can just keep adding steps to it, and going forward. And the way I look at it too, to kind of get back to your original question, is one of the hardest things about, I think, certainly if you're looking to do a nutritional ketosis, like medical ketosis style diet, is, you know, the framework, the infrastructure we have for food in our country does not match that. Like, you know, when we're talking nutritional ketosis, we're talking upwards of 90% fat sometimes. So like you have to go kind of out of your way to put together meals that match that. And that can be hard when the infrastructure is not necessarily there.
It's hard
there to
find new sponsors for the show too. that kicks out almost everybody. Uh-huh.
But in the reality of things, there's not going to be a whole lot of people, whether they're listeners or anyone in general, who are going to go that strict unless it's like, you know, for medical purposes. And nor do you really need to necessarily. Most, like, there's, if you're a healthy person in general, like, you know, you can take a higher fat approach and thrive on that, and you don't have to be quite as regimental. And the other thing to kind of touch back on that is the nice thing about the infrastructure we have nowadays, where food is so readily available in such variety, you could take almost any like nutritional approach and have easy access to the foods and have good tasting, you know, quality foods within that program. So if you're going to do a high fat diet, as long as you're, you know, willing to make your own food, which I think people should do no matter which approach they take, vegan, you know, high fat, whatever, you should be cooking your own food. It's a cool skill. It's fun. It's rewarding, and it's a lot more high quality. When you have that, you basically given yourself the power to kind of manipulate those things. And then you start finding out, you know, stuff you like, and then your psychology changes. So, you know, my psychology going in was, well, how am I going to cut back on the number of potatoes I ate? That's a psychological thing. You know, people are very, very ritualistic and oftentimes with what foods they're eating. And, when you get into that habit, that can be the biggest block to break through. But like Brad alluded to, once you get down the path and start doing it, you start to change that perception. That is, the psychology kind of switches. And then you're looking at, like, now I want these foods that I've been eating, whether they're like, you know, the eggs and bacon or, you know, all that stuff, the avocados, the oils and all that stuff. So you start to crave that stuff. You start to look forward to it. And, you know, another thing Brad mentioned, there's a lot of power in satiety. So if you've taught your body to metabolize fat, you've taught your body to tap into its largest energy source, whether you're, you know, super lean 5% body fat or you're, you know, higher than that, you know, you've got plenty on board to use from a day-to-day basis. So if you can tap into that, then you can conquer that hunger pang thing that would maybe bring you back to the dinner table before you actually needed to be.
So I guess if someone is seriously considering doing this, and they've been said, okay, I need to go higher fat. I know what a carbohydrate is. I know what a sugar is. I know what a protein is. I'm gonna restrict those. But what do I replace that with? And you're mm-hmm. saying fat. So is there a resource out there that someone can go to say, here are some good recipes or meals or food products that I can use to help me through this?
Yeah, stuffyourfatface.com has a whole bunch of...
Really?
No. We got to film this podcast because your gestures with your,
well, I was
your
just
fist
say,
pumping. Scott if, is if, like, he's really bringing it. He's bringing the heat. He's got a pencil pointer like Bill Clinton.
Yeah. If that's not a website that's taken, we need to get that website.
Well, we've got let's it along it. With our earlier one
Feed
today.
Feedyourfatface.com. Got it.
Brad has a book out. You've shared with me a recipe book that you've created that's available somewhere.
The keto reset is coming out in the fall of this year, and we'll have a ton of recipes in there that are keto friendly. But you know, this is a hot topic now. You can go into any bookstore and find all kinds of primal paleo ancestral health cookbooks. Keto cookbooks are going crazy now, and the main theme is that they're grain free, sugar free, and so the macronutrient composition of these assorted recipes are high in fat, moderate in protein, and very low in carb comparatively to our usual eating experience. So it's very difficult to align now because there's so much flexibility. And, you know, most of the whole natural nutritious foods, when we're talking about cutting carbs, we're really talking about cutting sugars and grains out of your diet. Because when you look at a giant serving of vegetables, there's not a ton of carbohydrate content in there. So don't get the misconception that this is like, you know, in the days of Atkins, it was criticized because you weren't supposed to eat fruit or vegetables and you could eat pork rinds all day and still score properly. No kidding. I mean, you could just, all it was a macronutrient challenge. And now today, with keto being this hyped thing that's jumped into consciousness, a lot of people are proceeding with an ill-advised approach by just focusing on macros and eating a bunch of crappy fat. Possibly eating too much protein is a big mistake, and making sure they cut the carbs. That's not the whole story here. So you can eat these high nutrient value carbohydrates that are high fibrous and watery, so they're not contributing a ton of calories. And at the same time, you know, finding all these different nutritious foods and recipes and snacks and the stuff I brought in today, the dark chocolate macadamia nut bark. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a treat that I bring to parties and people swarm me because it's so delicious. But you can literally consume this for breakfast because it's so healthy. It's got high antioxidant value with the dark chocolate. It's 85% dark chocolate. It's blended up macadamia nuts, almond butter, and coconut butter. And you refrigerate it and it comes out in a bark type of consistency. And it seems like a treat, but it's something like 80% fat, 10% protein, 10% carbs. So it's a keto-friendly treat that can serve as a meal or, you know, your breakfast.
It's so good and guilt-free. Scott, I'm going to jump in, if I may, just for a second.
It's your podcast. Go ahead. No,
I just want to go ahead, and then I have a caveat that I need to throw in.
Atkins diet. I had that thought earlier, and how does it relate to, was it far off? Was it close? Was it moving that direction? Where is Atkins compared to this ketogenic diet?
Well, I don't want to sound off like an expert on the Atkins diet, but the people were aware of this phase that started in the 70s, and it was completely opposite of all the dietary communication to that point. And it was this idea that if you lowered carbohydrate intake, extremely lowering carbohydrate intake would moderate your insulin production, and you'd start burning stored body fat. And it worked like a charm, and people could lose tons of weight. But that was kind of the basics. And then if we want to be healthy and we want to promote longevity and we want to think of a bigger picture strategy than just going in for a medically supervised weight loss experience, now we're talking and have it be sustainable, then we just kind of open it up to what about the nutrient value of your diet? Mm. Just like I'm saying with my buddy Rip, you know, what about all this common ground? He's like, yeah, I don't really believe in drinking my calories. I want to get whole foods. I'm like, same with us. Why should you drink, you know, something when you can sit down and have a salad? So, you know, this is kind of, it's more agreeable, I think, to speak in these big picture terms where if you don't like something, you don't have to eat it. But you want to set that goal of emphasizing nutrient-dense foods that are high in natural, nutritious fats. And if you, you know, if you have one takeaway from the show, no matter who you are, and if you're running hundreds of miles a week and the whole thing, cut out grains and sugars, and your life will be a lot better, and so will your endurance performance, by the way. and also the refined vegetable oils, which are so damaging. And probably the number one thing to cut out of your diet is the refined, high polyunsaturated vegetable oils. You see those in a bottle, like canola, sunflower, soybean, all that stuff, and then all the packaged snacks and frozen foods and restaurant foods that we consume. An estimated 40% of the calories from the standard American diet come from vegetable oils. Dr. Andrew Weil states that soybean oil alone, which is a particularly offensive agent that creates oxidative damage as soon as you consume it, is possibly 20% of all the calories in the American diet. And then when you add grains, grain-based foods, sugars and sweetened beverages and sugary foods and the oils together, it's somewhere up over two-thirds of all of our calories are completely devoid of nutritional value, or almost completely, and we're just getting a small sliver of the things that we really need as humans. So this kind of stuff, I don't think there's going to be a lot of dispute that there's no place for a nutrient devoid food in the diet. And then you sit back and go, well, what's my diet going to look like then? It's going to kind of trend toward a higher fat intake, because so many high-fat foods are nutritious. There's also bad fats, like the oils, that you should have zero tolerance for. But now we're going into, if you're inclined, animal products. We've only been eating them for 2.5 million years, so they're okay. Sorry, vegetarians and vegans. I know there's other reasons on the table here. But you can try to make it work with a moral objection to consuming animals, especially feedlot animals, which are objectionable to everybody. But if you can throw in some eggs or some sardines or whatever your rules are, or even if not, you can find the avocados and the olives and the coconut products that will get you those nutritious fats that will form the foundation, especially if you're a trail runner, to help you burn body fat, which is what you're trying to do out there on the trails.
In my 20s during college, I think that about two-thirds of my calories came from Coca-Cola. but I want to throw in one caveat that I learned from my general physician, who is an endurance athlete. And at the time, I was trying to get a lot of my calories through doing some juicing. And I talked to him about that, and he stopped me and he said, "So how many apples could you sit down and eat right now?" And I go, Maybe two. And he goes, "But yet you're putting three apples in a juice mixture and drinking that." Mm-hmm. He said, "Think about that for a minute." He says, "Juicing is good to a limit, but usually we're putting way too much stuff in there and trying to consume it." He says, "It's better just to eat the whole thing."
Oh, of course, yeah. And if you're doing keto and you're, you know, possibly you know, you've restricted your carbohydrates, including your intake of produce and all that, it's possibly a strategy to throw in a whole bunch of kale into a smoothie and make sure that you're drinking it in the morning. That's fine. But you want to have a macronutrient balance smoothie, so you're throwing an avocado in there, maybe a tablespoon or two of coconut oil. Your base is almond milk or coconut milk that's unsweetened. And then you're getting, instead of a sugar bomb, which is the main objection with juicing, you're getting something that's more of a nutrient-dense drink that'll allow you to have that sort of convenience when you can't sit down and have a delicious salad every day, for sure, yeah.
Zach, I'm going to assume that you were a potato-dependent carbohydrate runner initially.
He was okay. Sponsored by Idaho Russet Potatoes.
And then this is coming to you next, Brad. How long did it take you to convert from the potato king to the fat-adapted runner? And what did you experience before and after?
Yeah.
Take us through that.
So, you know, it's interesting because I might not be the very best example, because before I switched to, you know, a higher fat approach, I was very much health food minded, where like I was following basically a whole foods diet. Like I wasn't eating like tons of packaged food, tons of like, I wasn't drinking sodas and stuff like that. So I kind of had like a big part of the hard stuff in the beginning eliminated already. So for me to kind of switch my macros around from, you know, higher carb to higher fat was just like picking a few different foods in place of other ones. So like, you know, for me, what one thing I did was, well, I looked at my breakfast. So I had been eating like, you know, a bowl of oatmeal with some raw honey and cinnamon or something like that. I'm like, well, I'm going to have some eggs and avocado instead. Mm-hmm. And that one meal alone basically flipped the macros on their head in terms of carbs to fat ratio. And so right there, I just skewed myself towards fat, you know, by just switching one meal, changing one thing I did that day. And it was easy because you're always motivated in the beginning of the day. You haven't lost that ability to stay on point. So that's a lot of times what I'll advise people to do is let's work on breakfast, and then after they've got that down, now let's work on lunch, now let's work on dinner, and make it kind of like a gradual approach. For me personally, like on top of the fact that, you know, I was, I guess, in a decent position to transition because I wasn't eating a bunch of processed, packaged, you know, sugary drinks and stuff like that. I guess maybe this is why I'm an ultra marathon runner as well, is like when I get excited or curious about something, I'm not afraid to kind of dive into it. So for me, it was super intriguing. Like I wanted to know, like that kind of like quest or that need to kind of like figure out how this is going to, or see how this is going to change the way I perform, the way I recover, the way I sleep, the way I feel, was really motivating for me. There's people who just, they're not wired in that direction where it's like, you know, they want to be healthy, they want to feel good, but, they don't have this like, you know, quest in their mind, like, oh, this is going to be so cool to find this out. They're more like, just tell me what to do so I can do it kind of a mentality. So, you know, I think I had that stuff working for me, but that's not necessarily going to be everyone's experience. So kind of taking a more gradual, sustainable approach is usually kind of the way I would do it.
This is still coming at you, Brad, but first I'm going to ask you, since you coach at zachbitter.com, right, if the people reach out for some coaching, if you could help in just one area, would it be more their physical component or their nutrition? Where do you think people really could improve their game by focusing on one of those two areas in your experience working with your people?
Yeah, that's you know, one of the reasons I got into coaching, because there's so much individual need and individual scenarios where, you know, I'd have a hard time saying that there's maybe more one than another, because I get a lot of clients who love to run but have really never explored beyond like, let's just go for a run. You know, that person has a lot of growth that they can potentially get. Their ceiling is very high in what they can do in terms of having a structured training approach. You know, but then there's also folks who just haven't ever really thought twice about what they're eating too. So they have a high ceiling as well. So it really depends on the person. You know, sometimes I'll get people who are super dialed in the diet, and we just make a couple tweaks here and there, and you know, they're often running with that, but have a really low like exposure to quality training, and then, you know, they're going to grow away more from that side. And then same thing on the other end of the spectrum. Sometimes it's they've done every type of workout, they've had every like coaching methodology and process, and they just have never really thought twice about what they're eating, and then we're going to definitely target that. So anytime I'm coaching someone, I ask myself, where is this person's biggest area of growth potential? And that's something we're going to focus on, because that's going to get them the biggest return on their investment. But we're also going to work on all those other things as well to try to make the whole picture really complete.
Brad Kearns, professional athlete, been on covers of triathlon-type magazines. You've been on ABC running in spandex little bikini shorts. You've stood on the top position in the podium at races, a carbohydrate-dependent athlete at one time, and then the switch went for you to become more fat-adapted. Share us your experience of conversion.
Was it difficult at first?
First, I want to answer that coaching one, because something important came to mind. It's about time for the wise guy element of the show, too.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm going to give the answer. I want you listeners to know I'm speaking from the heart. I care about you, and I've been there myself. But when you ask about what's the best return on investment for what to attack with coaching, you asked, is it diet or is it the physical training? I got a third idea, and that's the psychological element.
Oh, good point.
And I don't want to talk about this too long, so I'm only going to offer three words up, but it could change your life as an athlete if you focus on this.
Okay, go back down to half speed so you can write it down.
You know, our general experience of the population in the endurance scene. I'm from the triathlon world, but the ultra scene and everybody's got this type A mode going, because otherwise why would we pursue these crazy goals? It's not general population society. There's not 18,000 people running the trail run. There's 180.
Right.
And so it's get over yourself. Because what we find is just this repeated pattern of overly stressful lifestyle practices, overly stressful training habits, and all these things, actually, back to the diet question, they push us in the direction of carbohydrate dependency. Because when you're wired for stress and you're in this hectic fight-or-flight overstimulation mode throughout the day, whether it's from a workout where your heart rate was too elevated, you're running from one appointment to the next and squeezing a workout in the middle, all these kind of things kind of push you towards sugar cravings, carb dependency, compromised fat metabolism. So if we kind of relax our approach to the sport and take what our body gives us each day and nothing more, then we're starting to get in a more a better position to pursue peak performance and achieve breakthroughs and actually enjoy it more than the overly stressful approach, which I discovered with so many clients, that they're just worked up about the particulars of their nutritional strategy and what should my macros be during the long run. I'm like, I don't know, man. Do you have a calculator out there that you're going to even be able to? And when we're talking, we're throwing out these words in the podcast like, oh, it's 70% fat. Oh, that's a lot. How does anyone know what the composition of their diet is unless they're in a nutritional science program in a college setting? It's like, we don't know. So we want to focus on just a more relaxed approach to lifestyle transformation. Whatever you're doing on your daily workout and even your race performance is not life or death. And I've been around so many elite athletes where a lot of times you see this disposition, surprisingly, in real life. If you got to know Zach Bitter away from the race course and his interviews at the finish line, the athletes are able to go with the flow better than the average wound up amateur participant, the elite people. Yeah. Because when I was a triathlete for 9 years, it was my living. It was whether I paid the mortgage or not, or got groceries or those kind of things, was life or death matter of whether I'm going to perform or not. So there was a lot of stakes, high stakes riding on my performance. But when I got caught up in myself and the importance of what I was doing and the importance of every single workout and measuring and judging my performance every day, that's when I struggled and suffered. And when I got back to this position of just being able to enjoy what I was doing every day and push my body to the maximum and see what I could get out of my body and enjoy this amazing challenge of going for the highest level of competition against the other athletes, that's when I was able to tap into the magic of just getting the most out of my body and having it happen sort of automatically and naturally rather than trying to force things to happen because some coach told me this was the best workout to do or, you know, this diet was the regimented, restricted diet that was going to get me an edge in the competition. All those things are very fragile as opposed to being in that state of bliss and enjoyment that you're doing something that you want to do.
You know, I've benefited from Brad Kearns long before I knew you personally, from a couple of real close friends and training partners. Bob Powers is one who's a friend of yours too, and Julie Fingar as well. And the one word I would use to describe what was passed down from Brad to these people and then to me was intuition. Be intuitive. Be an intuitive runner. Be an intuitive eater. Be an intuitive sleeper. Just learn to listen to your body. And that has been really a real pivotal component of, I think, you know, what I've tried to practice. So intuition. Can you just speak a little bit about that word direct from the horse's mouth this time instead of from a training partner? I'd love to hear it. Intuition.
Well, they misunderstood him.
He never used the word intuition. He was anti-intuition.
I think you should really be regimented about everything in your life. Yeah. Well, you know, we have these instincts, right? I mean, animals have instincts, and so do humans. And you have an instinct to catch that fool who just passed you on the trail and pass him back and all those kind of things. But unlike animals, humans have the ability to put that higher reasoning into the picture. So we have ability to reason with our instincts. And so when it comes to, like, training decisions, I had a poor event. I got my butt kicked in the swim. I'm flying home and I'm writing down. I'm like, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to swim twice as hard this week because I'm so frustrated and emotional about my diminished performance and not meeting my goals. So I'm going to go out there and burn extra energy and get into this frenzied high stress mentality where I'm going to take it out on the water, or on the pedals. And that's kind of an inability to manage your animal instincts. So when you're intuitive, you realize that whatever I'm doing is not so important anyway. I can relax and accept that I have a bad event and not let it affect my self-esteem. And then when you're making a decision, once in a while, what I would find out was I'd be feeling great for 6 weeks in a row, and I'd be setting new PRs, and I'm building upon the previous week's training, and I feel fantastic. And then I get to week seven, I'm like, wow, I'm not tired yet, but you know what? Something's funny here because I'm way over what my normal capabilities are. And Maffetone talks about this, and a lot of the scientists are saying you're in this heightened stress response where your body's putting out a bunch of stress hormones to keep up with the demand of what you're throwing at it, but you're setting yourself up for a crash. Mm-hmm. And so you have to reason with your animal instinct to go out there and kick some more butt and realize that maybe it's time to take some time off, even though I feel great. And to me, that's the highest level of training sophistication, where you can sit down and understand what you're all about. And Andrew McNaughton says this on our podcast a lot. He says, I train according to my moods. He's been doing this stuff for 30 years at the elite level. He's still an elite amateur triathlete. He was a champion back on the pro circuit in the 80s and 90s. And now his sole governing decisions about training is what mood he's in. So he feels like biking today. He feels like running. He feels like going long and hard. He feels like going around the block and coming home and taking a nap. And those kind of things are so rich and valuable. And we continually reject them over and over because we want to have a type A answer rather than this thing of just relaxing and going with your intuition. Most people are so disconnected from their intuition. They don't even know that this is a terrible career for them. They should have been out of it 7 years ago, and tomorrow would be a great day to quit your job. It's not even in the brain because they're just moderated to something else, habituated to something else.
If people want to hear that, they can go to Primal Endurance Podcast.
Yeah, Primal Endurance Podcast. We talk a lot about just the, you know, getting away from the overly regimented, now there's all this biofeedback that didn't even exist when I was training. I don't even know what a Fitbit is. I just hear it talked about all the time. But apparently you can measure and track everything that's going on. And there's a place for that. I like HRV. I like testing my ketones and glucose and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, watch your moods, watch your motivation levels. Don't force things to happen that aren't naturally meant to be. And that means that sometimes you're not going to be a rock star out there, and that's okay. You can go and volunteer at the Bloody Race and hand out water and turn your number in instead of going there when your temperature is 101 and risking, you know, illness, injury, breakdown.
So the original question back to you, tell us about your conversion, your switch from carbohydrates to fat. What'd you notice?
Original questions.
Yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah. One thing that it's important to start out with on this topic, this is from Dr. Kate and also Dr. Peter Attia, that carbohydrates are objectionable only when they disturb homeostasis. So if you've just run 20 miles and you're coming home and you're having a few potatoes like Zach used to do, that's not going to be a big health risk for an athlete of that caliber, right? Now, if you're carrying excess body fat, we'll stop the, you can put pause right here on the show and write down on a piece of paper, yes or no. Do you have excess body fat? Yes or no. Okay, come back onto the show. And whatever your answer was, you're going on a different, that's a fork in the road. So on this fork in the road, if you have excess body fat that you would like to remove from your body, you got to cut your carbohydrate intake down and drop that body fat, lower insulin, and get it off your body. There's no reason why you should have it if you're an ultra-distance trail runner. There's no reason. There's something wrong. What's wrong is you're carbohydrate dependent. So first we want to solve that. That usually seems like to most people the biggest problem to solve or the biggest wish is to drop that excess body fat. Now, once that's taken care of, then we're going to say that carbohydrates are only offensive when they disturb homeostasis. And by that, I mean they're stimulating this insulin response, which is inflammatory, promotes oxidation and inflammation in the bloodstream, heart disease patterns. All this stuff come from high insulin-producing diet. It's the number one health problem in Western society and the leading cause of metabolic syndrome. And that's in agreement with all physicians and medical experts. It's not disputed that high insulin contributes to metabolic syndrome.
Time out real quick because this is one of my questions. I was listening to a podcast. Actually, it's a very cool podcast name. It's called Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show. I don't know if you've heard of that. But I just did to Dr. Jeff Folick, who brought up the whole idea of metabolic syndrome. Can you explain metabolic syndrome since you brought it up?
It's a collection of like five risk factors that can be found in the blood and that are indicative of metabolic syndrome. And it's like high triglycerides, low HDL, a high fasting blood glucose. Three is close enough for trail runners, but it's a sign that your diet, very diet related, increasing heart disease risk factors and obesity and type 2 diabetes and all that. Little quick stat about type 2 diabetes. If we continue on our current progression of how many people are picking this up, and now we can keep them alive for many, many years, it's very, very expensive. But if we continue at the existing rate of type 2 diabetes growth, the U.S. Treasury will be bankrupt in like 2060. It'll bankrupt the country, the healthcare costs of keeping type 2 diabetics alive. There's right now, what's like 40 million people are type 2 and another 30 million are pre-type 2. It's a disaster. And it comes from excessive carbohydrate intake, excessive insulin production. So,
not good.
So you asked me about my transition.
Yeah, that was 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. So the athletic listeners, the people who are out there doing exercise and putting in miles, will have a much easier time transitioning over and away from carbohydrate dependency if they're training properly. If they're in an overstressed training pattern or overstressed lifestyle pattern, you almost shouldn't even mess with your diet until you get your sleep handled, until you get your stress management handled, until you get your chronic exercise patterns handled. And I think on the last show we talked a little bit about if you're regularly exceeding your maximum aerobic heart rate in training, you are in a chronic exercise sugar burning pattern, and you're not going to be able to withstand the Ben and Jerry's pint, another sponsor we lost.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Dang. You're not going to be able to withstand those sugar cravings because your brain and your body are depleted and they're telling you to replenish with energy. It's a human instinct that's inescapable. So first you get your life stress patterns handled so that you have the potential to transition away from a carbohydrate dependency diet, drop that excess body fat quickly and easily, and then perhaps as you keep going down the road, explore the performance advantages offered by going keto and all that great stuff. But we can't just jump in and say, yeah, I want to beat Zach Bitter next time, so I'm going to cut out my potatoes too. We have to go on the progressive steps, or it's just going to be folly like all the other diets that you've tried and failed on.
So what did it feel like going from carbohydrate? Back to the question. Did it feel like for you to get rid of the carbohydrates and move your diet?
I don't think he's avoiding it.
I don't know if he's heard.
He just hasn't answered it.
Yeah. Answer that question.
That's because you guys saw me at the In-N-Out drive-in. And they're like, what are you doing with those fries?
I have a photo of him. I'm going to hold him hostage.
Yeah. So here's my progression was back in 08. I got together with Mark Sisson, my old friend, and we decided to work on the Primal Blueprint and push this primal message out. So I actually went cold turkey in June of 08 and cut out grains and sugars. And my diet was pretty clean and healthy, like you report, Zach. So it wasn't like I was, you know, in the In-N-Out line too much. I was in there for my kids, which was disgraceful because I swore, like when I had little kids and they were born, I'm like, they're never going to have fast food. They're not going to have messy toys all around the house like we see at some of our friends' houses.
Right?
And they're going to be this, they're going to be that, they're going to exercise and do all this every day. And it's like, oh my gosh, the pressures of the world are tough, man. And so I find myself going to In-N-Out like, yeah, yeah. So I went cold turkey in 08 and cut out grains and sugar. So all of a sudden I was primal, and it was a little difficult, I'd say, for, you know, 6 week period where I'm in the afternoon and I'm feeling a little foggy because I'm so used to banging a Larabar or something. Great product,
yeah.
Just a little too many carbs for this type of approach, but it's healthy and natural and there's nothing wrong with it. But I wanted to, you know, get into this new mode. So there was a bit of a struggle there, but guess what? You get to assuage your struggle with a giant omelet instead of a giant bowl of cereal. I transitioned over to a 5 or 6 egg omelet every morning to replace my cereal. And so I didn't struggle that much. It's no trouble to eat this huge amount of food and burn it and feel satisfied and nourished. And then a year or two down the line, all of a sudden I'm waking up and finding that I don't even need the omelet. So that was my progression from giant mixing bowl of cereal every day from when I was a triathlete and keeping that pattern up even when I wasn't training a lot, and then going to something that's going to replace that, and then finally realizing that as you get more and more fat adapted, you don't even need a meal. You can just cruise along. And then guess what happens? Food becomes one of the great pleasures of life that it should be, where you're sitting down and eating a meal because you want to enjoy the meal. Or maybe you took it to the point where you got hungry, which is a great practice and a great strategy, which, I don't know, raise your hands out there. You can pause the recording again, but how many of us have experienced, you know, legitimate hunger in the past week? Mostly we preempt it with constant overfeeding, which has all kinds of negative health consequences. So that was my transition from first going into primal in 08, and then so I'm 8 years into this thing, and I decided to try keto. And I will say, my first attempt at it, I went and saw Dr. Maffetone in Arizona, and he convinced me, he's like, yeah, you should be keto because you're complaining of crash and burn afternoon and sleepiness, whatever. He goes, yeah, go for it. So I did it for 3 weeks. It was great. I wasn't hungry. I was lauding the benefits. I was putting pictures up on Instagram of my meals. And then at week three, I kind of like spun out of it, and it was pretty heavy. Like I just got hungry at the Burbank Airport, gate A2, my favorite gate. And I went across the thing, and I bought out all the snack bags of almonds, and I was just inhaling food. And it was like my body was just struggling, and like 3 weeks is the toughest point when you're going under 50 grams a day, and you hit this kind of lull, and you have to work through it and can have a lot of high-fat, satisfying foods to do that. But as you pull out of 3 weeks and get up to 6 weeks, which is kind of the recommended minimum, my D'Agostino says this, then it starts to get easier and easier. So that first time, I bailed at 3 weeks, and I went back to more of a primal, aligned eating, which is still under 150 grams of carbs a day. It's not a lot, but I couldn't hang that first time. So I waited 6 months, and then I tried it again, and I did much better. So I should say, like, there's no failure here. If you try to restrict carbs for a week and you do pretty well and you have, you know, a good string of days, and then it's Cheesecake Factory birthday party on the weekend and you go and you hit it hard, and then the next day you hit it hard again, and then it's time to go on your cruise and you have 14 days of just desserts and parfaits and all that stuff, it's okay because you put that little bit of work in at the start, that week of restricting carbs, and you can leverage that each time. And as you go forward in the future, there's no failure. It's just trying to become more metabolically flexible and stringing together some momentum and using your workouts and your training to leverage that, because when you deplete your glycogen through a workout and then go nourish yourself with a high-fat food, you're sending a message to your brain that you're not carbohydrate addicted, that you can do a workout, fast for an hour after, then go eat an omelet, and that's the way to spin out of the giant oatmeal bowl in the morning.
Someone's listening to this and they say, I'm in. I want to do this. They have a race coming up on the calendar. What would you advise them about, it's only 3 weeks away. Why don't you start after? Is there any advice like that that you would give? Or, heck, start now and you're better off tomorrow. Just go for it.
Yeah, I think that kind of addresses one of the biggest roadblocks for people is, you know, it's one of the things where, like, we live in a society now where excess is very, very prevalent, whether you're looking at your food options, your access to technology. It goes back to, like, you know, are there cookbooks? Or, like, just Google high-fat meals and you have millions of different options. You know, those are the positives of excess. We have all this information, all these resources at our fingertips. You know, and the negatives are sometimes it puts us in this mode of, like, I want this now, I need this now, or I want to change this overnight. And it really, you have to kind of step back and be patient, because like Brad said, it's not something like anything good isn't going to happen overnight like that. Like you have to really be willing to go through the process of learning, of experiencing. And if you frame it right and look at that as kind of a good thing, like this is a journey, this is something I'm going to remember and it's going to be meaningful for me, as opposed to like this quick switch flipped and then all of a sudden boom, I'm where I wanted to be. You got to kind of embrace that process, and you know, it might be something where like Brad was saying, like you get pretty dialed in for 3 days and then you fall off the wagon, and then a lot of people say, okay, that's a failure. Well, not really, because you just did 3 days, which is 3 days more than you were doing before, so that was growth. So get back on the wagon, you know, see if you can make it 4 days next time, and then just keep looking at those. Look at the growth as opposed to the decline, and start seeing failure as like learning lessons learned and stuff. Because maybe you look and say like, okay, I didn't succeed at making it to the part I wanted to, or as long as I wanted to do something specific. You know, I see why that happened. You know, being reflective and stuff like that, and really kind of looking at the whole picture and trying to get where you want to be through steps, as opposed to trying to like change it overnight. So to answer your question, like I wouldn't ever mess with someone's nutrition approach 3 weeks before a race, because you know, that's not really anything that's gonna, like, if I can't think of a scenario in which it would benefit them, you know, like that for that race itself. Now, if they were like, if they decided, oh, I'm way more interested in getting my nutrition dialed in, and if this race implodes on me, I'm fine with that, then maybe we would start looking at that, because then we could use that race as a gauge of like, let's see where you're at. in 3 weeks. Let's see how this how you're responding so far. So really, it comes down to where their primary goals are and stuff like that.
Anything to add to that, Brett?
Yeah, pick a shorter race. No, you know, that's great. I like that. Yeah.
Good.
You know, I have a question about, so mostly we've talked about becoming fat adapted through nutrition. There's also the whole exercise component and how that helps us become more fat adapted. Somebody was recently, I did a metabolic test with the UC Davis here in California and found out I was not well fat adapted. And we may have asked this question on another podcast, but this doctor was telling me that interval training or sprint training can also help generate more fat adaptation. Can you guys explain that? He explained it to me and and it made sense, but then I tried to explain it to Don and I couldn't.
Because I wasn't able to understand it?
No, I couldn't explain it. But the doctor explained it that it does help. There's interval training and sprints.
It definitely does. What you have to ask yourself, though, is to what extent? So, you know, you can definitely go on like fasted runs in a high carb approach, and you're going to see some growth of like your ability to metabolize fat as a nutrient. Traditionally, before we've started getting more studies in the last few years, they would say like, you know, you would peak out at like I'm talking outlier on the chart, 0.9 to 1.0 grams of fat per minute metabolized. So that person wasn't probably burning that like sitting around all day. Like that's not how they got to that level. They got to that level by probably like, you know, doing a lot of long aerobic endurance workouts and stuff and teaching their body how to burn fat. Now there's kind of a ceiling to it there, right? Where we saw on the charts where there was one person at like 1.0 or 0.9 or something like that. And most people were closer to like 0.7. Now, if you add on top of that the training, you know, whether it's the interval training or the, you know, long distance running and stuff, and then also add on top of it, you know, skewing your macronutrients closer to fat as your primary source, then you're hitting that from two different angles. And then we're seeing results now that would otherwise have been off the charts. Like for me personally, I got tested and I metabolized at my peak fat oxidation rate 1.56 grams per minute. So that was 50% higher than the biggest outlier on the chart. And I wasn't even the highest one. There was a guy there who did like, I think it was like 1.7 grams per minute or something like that. So he's, you know, he's like three times above the average, almost double the outlier. So it's like rewriting textbooks, so to speak, in terms of what you can do. Like you can make a jump forward through training, but you can make an enormous jump forward through training and also introducing more fats in your diet.
Guys, pause the bloody recording right there. I mean, listeners, sit down and write that down. You can get more endurance by changing your diet. You don't have to run any more miles. And it's this is why I think, you know, this is the best show that's ever been done on Trail Runner Nation. But I also think why...
Second best, you were on earlier.
To have a free pass when we're working so hard and putting out so much energy in training and existing in a carbohydrate dependency training state, and now you can access more fat grams per minute, and we could do a whole science show on how important that number is. But that's the difference between that's why some guys run the way too cool in 320, and some of them run it in 620, is they're better at burning fat, and they're not exhausting their glycogen stores by when they run at that speed. And so that's kind of, this has been for 50 years, the essence of getting good at endurance sports is to become more efficient at burning fat and sparing glycogen. And you do that by putting in a ton of miles and working really hard and doing hill repeats. And then, and you also just get rid of the cereal and switch to the omelet, and you're going to burn more grams of fat per minute, all other things being equal with your training. It's incredible. It's like it should be 99% adoption among the ultra distance in the endurance community, and it will be in 20 years. So if you want to be an early adopter, replay this show and start doing it.
And let's talk about running those hot canyons out there and having the blood where it should be in the muscle, close to the skin to cool you down, and not in the stomach trying to figure out what to do with that foil-wrapped container of stuff.
Yeah. So here's, you got to tell us some of those stats again that you told me on the video, like the ability to prolong your exercise with minimal calories is a huge performance advantage because you don't have, this is a horrible time to ingest and assimilate calories when you're running 630 miles for 7 hours or something. So in the 100K championship, you consume like 100 calories an hour extra, 150 calories, and that was it?
Yeah, it was 100. That was at Mad City 100K. I took in 150 calories an hour, I think. And to put that in perspective, before when I was high carbohydrate, you know, I would routinely take in 4 to even upwards of 500 calories per hour. So when you're looking at the amount of, like, non-needed fueling that I was doing, just based on what I was deciding to eat when I wasn't training, and you know, that's not hard, like in terms of like exhausting, like it's exhausting to go out and train peak, you know, weeks. It's not exhausting just to like, you know, decide to have, you know, an omelet instead of the oatmeal or whatever I decided to switch in and out. And what that allowed me to do was to greatly reduce the level of carbohydrate I needed to take in during the event. And to kind of answer Don's question is, When you're running a race, your body is, it has this blood volume, this supply of blood, and it's using it to do all these different things. It's using it for your muscles to function. It's using it to cool you. If you eat something, it's using it to digest. Your body's like shuttling blood to all these different areas. So ideally, when you're trying to meet peak performance, you want that blood to be reserved for the things that are going to keep you moving and moving quickly, and that's for muscle function and for cooling if it's a hot day. So you throw in a whole other variable of eating food, it's just taking away from that potential supply. So like, I'm not saying you necessarily want to go out and run 100 miles and eat absolutely nothing, but if you can minimize that by 50%, 60%, 70% like I did, then all of a sudden you're not pinging your body to send blood to your stomach for digestion as often. And you know, one of the telltale signs in endurance sport, if you're eating too much or if your body doesn't have the requisite blood volume to help with digestion and function, is if you eat something or a variety of things and then you end up puking it up. And it's like, if you do that, then that means that your body wasn't able to send the blood to your stomach to help with that digestion. It came in and your body said, what am I going to do with this? I don't have the resources to digest this properly. And then it sends it right back out.
I guess it's no surprise that it's a common sight to see a trail runner bent over and heaving and clearing the stomach out, right?
It's laughable that we're here, what, 40 years after the first Western States and Hawaii Ironman, and we still have, there was a recent stat that this is the Hawaii Ironman World Championship, so everyone's highly qualified, and there's 30% of the field had extreme digestive distress. And it's like, you're never going to get away from that distress when you're trying to especially ingest glucose during high energy performance. And then secondly, even if you can consume all your calories and not puke it up, you're creating a lot of oxidative stress from metabolizing glucose. Glucose is a dirty burning fuel. It does not require mitochondria to burn. And mitochondria is protective against the oxidative stress because mitochondria are like these little power plants in each cell that produce energy efficiently. So when you're burning fat and ketones, you're burning clean burning fuel, and you're kind of like a Tesla car with this big, beautiful engine. There's no smoke coming out of the tailpipe. There's no you're not worried about running out of energy. You have, you know, a lot of charge in your electric car, as opposed to the, you know, low octane fuel source that's glucose. Even if you can ingest it, you need more of it. It's very, very fragile. Everyone knows what it's like to bonk and just miss time, or you miss the aid station, or you have a story at the finish line rather than being a fat burning beast. So Zach was talking about burning 150 grams and 150 calories an hour. You're running 6 minute miles or 6:30s or something like that in that race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you're going slow, like you told me, you paced your buddy at Western States overnight. Tell us the duration of that effort and what you ate.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm always kind of experimenting with stuff, and it's, you know, a lot of times I like to try it rather than like rely on, you know, like a blood glucose monitor or a ketone strip thing to see like, oh, I'm in ketosis. That means I'm burning tons of fat. I can do this. I like to just go out and see if I can do it. And then if I can, then it means I'm doing something right. So I've done a variety of different like training stimuluses where I've gone very low or no fuel just to see like how I felt, how I responded and stuff. And one year I was pacing the last 38 miles at, at Western States, and I was my goal was to do it with just water and electrolytes if possible, and just to see how I felt throughout that. And I did it. I did the whole thing without taking any food, other than I think I had like a handful of like melon or something at one aid station. I think it was just because I was getting kind of, you know, we were out there for.
Was he? You're groping the aid station attendant?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So it was. You know, it was. You know, very little fuel. Like I probably took in like 50 calories in 7 hours or something like that, and over the course of 38 miles. And one thing I was just really, really conscious about was making sure I was getting in liquids and getting in like electrolytes. So, you know, like whether that was, I can't remember, it was whatever electrolyte thing they had at the aid station, whatever capsule, whether it was like salt stick or S caps or whatever it was. I was just doing that in water pretty much the whole way. And you know, it's when you're working at a lower intensity, like you can kind of expect to be doing if you're pacing someone who's already ran 100 kilometers, you know, it's a good, I think, spot to kind of try that stuff and see like, okay, where is my fat adaptation at? Like, can I get through this low intensity, but very much long and potentially mentally fatiguing, because you're still moving through potentially late hours of the night where you normally be sleeping. You're potentially trying to, well, not potentially, you're taking care of your runner. You're making sure that they're getting what they need and where they're supposed to be. So for me, that was a good spot to kind of test that out. And I wouldn't say routinely, but sporadically, basically any training block I do, I'm going to do something similar to that just to kind of see like, all right, where is my fat adaptation at? And am I in a position to, like what Brad said, am I fat adapted enough to be able to count on that? And then, where can I drop in the carbohydrates very, very strategically to kind of like get that extra boost, I guess, so to speak.
I'm a little slow sometimes, Brad, but I think I caught your reference of what you were groping. I think that's the wrong type of melons at the aid station.
I groped a few melons during my 40-mile run.
That went way over my head. I didn't get it. You had to explain it to me.
We need a few more carbohydrates. We're not quite fat adapted yet. Hey, this has been a great conversation, and I think it could go on and on and on, and it will continue to be debated within our community. But I think when the truth finally lands, it will be fat adaption is the way to go. It's a cleaner fuel. It's very available. It's a moving aid station on the course. It's there wherever you need it. We'll certainly need to watch our fluid intake because we don't necessarily can't go on forever without the fluid. But we have the fuel on us, and that's been proven over and over again. And to the gentleman to my right, he's done it. And it'll be interesting to watch him at
Western
States.
Zach's on his right, by the way, just so you know. Those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, Zach is to his right.
I've set the board up, so they should be able to hear that he's to the right of me.
He's coming in on the right here?
It'll be, yes.
Oh, interesting.
It'll be fun to watch Western States this year with you out there, fat adapted and training and doing all that stuff. So that'll be good. And we can find you at zachbitter.com if we need some coaching or some advice, and watch your blog and some of your entries that you put there, because you're full disclosure. You don't hide behind content or ideas. You put it out there for all of us to become better runners ourselves, and we do appreciate that. Tell us about your book, Brad Kearns.
Keto Reset.
Keto Reset. When will it be available? How do we get it? And tell us about that.
It's coming out in the fall, so look forward in the scene, and we're hoping to make a big impact. Because really, when you go in the bookstore now, it's mostly cookbooks and campy talk about this exciting new thing, keto, but this is a very comprehensive presentation of the topic, especially how to get there properly without the risk of backsliding and failure that happens so many times when you go into extreme carbohydrate modification especially. So it's a progression where, you know, your first step and a good takeaway for the podcast is if you're into it, you're thinking about this, you're going to try it, cut out grains, sugars, and refined vegetable oils from your diet. Zero tolerance for 21 days. Just do it. And instead, transition over to really nourishing, nutrient-dense meals like the omelet we described and the salad for lunch and the steak or fish for dinner with vegetables, and slather them in butter and get a lot of fat into your diet so you're satisfied, you're never struggling or suffering. And that's the step one, is to get that junk out of your diet so that you can give yourself a fighting chance at becoming fat-adapted and progressing further down the line.
If you want to get in there before the fall release, there's Primal Blueprint that's out there currently. How do we get a hold of that, and what will we learn from that?
Yeah, for your listeners, I mean, Primal Endurance is the book that we released last year. And we talked about it here on the show, on an old show. And that's really directed the Primal Paleo message to the endurance community and how to kind of capture some of these benefits of protecting yourself from the oxidative stress and the damage and the aging that comes from training for endurance sports. Guess what? It's not that healthy for you if you're doing it in this carbohydrate dependency chronic exercise pattern. So that book talks about first, you know, slowing down and understanding how to build an aerobic base and not overstress yourself, and then put the diet piece in after you've handled that big picture of an overly stressful training program, overly stressful lifestyle patterns, insufficient sleep, all that stuff.
And don't forget the podcast, Primal Endurance Podcast. It's one of the ones on my favorites that I download more than every week.
Rap at the start of the show, my soul's escaping from this hole that is gaping. Make me king. I'm a new move toward it, to a new world order. And I did it for a couple shows, and believe it or not, people wrote in, they said, dude, I dug the rapping. I'm like, are you kidding? I'm an old white guy trying to rap to Tupac. You know? I got the doctor hanging over me screaming, oh boy. So I keep doing it now because I'm goaded on by strange listeners, and so there's a lot of entertainment value.
Maybe Don, we should include some rapping by you in our podcast.
We'll work on it. I've been known to rap a little bit, not only at Christmas, but on mic when you're not around. The very first episode, you and Mark Sessions, just brilliant. I mean, if you're going to download an episode, start with the very first one. You guys really hammer the benefits of being fat adapted. So a great, great episode. It sold me.
And I'm sold on Trail Runner Nation. Oh. I mean, I'm not going to run on the roads anymore. I'm going to just stay on trails.
That's the best thing to do. So
can we have like an out greeting on the show? Like, until then, stay on the trail, stay off the roads.
That's going up. That's going on the intro.
Moss. Brad Kearns, thank you. Zach Bitter, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe I'm sick of you and the way you look, all the things you do. You drive me crazy. Sick of being broke, can't beat the shit. I'm about to snap, I can't handle it. I'm going crazy.